This might be Edinburgh, but it's a great honour to speak to Henry Blofeld and Peter Baxter, both known for their exploits on Test Match Special and general cricketing knowledge. As they're keen to emphasise, their show at the moment is not particularly about cricket. It's much more about broadcasting and about the experiences that they've enjoyed, and it is great fun. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having us. Great honour for us.
My pleasure. The first question is, where? I don't know which of you I'm addressing this to, but you will know. Where did this show come from? What made you decide you wanted to do the show? And then what made you decide you wanted to do it in Edinburgh?
About 3 years ago, we were sitting in a pub, having lunch, as one does, and we were swapping yarns from the old days. I suppose I hadn't seen Blurs for a few months. And a chap who owned the pub overheard us and said, yeah, you two ought to do this on stage. And Henry mentioned it to his agent, and suddenly the next thing we knew, we'd got six dates, and that increased. And then, lo and behold, we'd got last year's Edinburgh Festival. It's just sort of snowballed and gone on. And this year we're doing the whole of the festival.
How much is it scripted, and how much is it off the cuff?
It's really pretty well entirely off the cuff, but we do know what works. In the stories per se have been told before, we know which stories work. But I think if you hear it 2 days running, every story, you may hear the same stories, but they're told differently. They aren't word for word by any means every day. And there are different things that we occasionally slip in, the different asides. We pull each other's legs, you know. I tell him, he's always being beastly to me and asking him, telling us times, tell stories about times when I made a complete mess of things, you know. And that's all a bit different. But I think when you've got the discipline of having to do it inside an hour, you do in fact discipline yourselves. You work out more precisely what you're doing, what you're going to do, because you've got to. Because you've got to make sure you get in all the bankers, all the really good stories, you know. And so I think you do have, don't you, backers, you have certain parameters that perhaps when you're doing a show in two acts, which we normally are, of an hour in each act.
Yes, we're a bit more lax. But we're a couple of forgetful old chaps as well, so we occasionally forget stories and lines and that sort of thing. Usually we remind each other, but there are occasions when we both forget and... That story is saved for the next day.
Well, the story is saved for the next day, but we've always got the other things to call on. So, absolutely, I mean, one's going to notice it.
No.
And, of course, the great thing is that although we sometimes come off and think, oh, my goodness, we left this story out, or we only told half of that, or we forgot about this, we know, but no one else is going to know. Mm. And as long as the whole thing is smooth, it doesn't really matter. Because we haven't got to show up our prep and have it marked in red pencil, you know. So I think when we first began it, I think this was something we felt we had to get everything in every time. And then we suddenly became more relaxed as it became more popular. And I think it's all based on confidence.
Every audience gets a slightly different show because of that, mainly because of our fallibility, I think, as much as anything else.
Well, and indeed, every audience you come across is slightly different.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
There are audiences. I mean, this audience today we just had was wonderfully good. They probably laughed wholeheartedly rather less than yesterday, I felt.
I think that's true. They were a good audience.
Yes.
But there wasn't the sort of belly laugh.
They weren't. We didn't get quite the belly laughs. Whereas you knew they were with us and concentrating. But yesterday we got more outrageous, uproarious laughs.
And sometimes you get a reaction sort of halfway through a story. So you sort of divert. You know, you might say something and a voice from, oh dear, from the crowd. And you sort of react to that. And so it does change it a bit.
And also, if you get a really noisy audience, when I say noisy, I mean in terms of applause, it shortens the show in that you've got to wait for applause. You can't talk over applause. And therefore you find yourself, in fact, when you're doing a show of an hour in Edinburgh, you find yourself in the last 10 minutes, however well organised it is, you've got a traffic jam. And therefore we have to do a little bit of editing on our feet, which we did today. But we know it, but no one else knows it.
Absolutely.
In the same way that politicians can win elections on England winning the World Cup, too far back to remember, or winning the Ashes, is that affecting your show? Does the fact that England have just won a Test match, which has taken a long time, make a difference?
I really don't think it does. I mean, I think, you know, we did so badly in Australia last winter, but, I mean, there's a great gallows humour, isn't there, about about how badly we did, and you get quite a few laughs just talking about that.
I don't think it's got anything to do with that, no. Because I personally think that people like Test Match Special for what it is. It is an institution. It's a programme that has achieved its popularity probably as much, if not more, by its non-cricketing content as by its cricketing content. There is great humour in it. There is great going beyond the boundary. This was all started, really, in a way, well, not all of it, but a lot of it by Brian Johnston. And no one quite knows what to expect on Test Match Special. And I think that's one of its great attractions and why so many people listen to it. And I think that's one of the attractions with us, is that people don't know quite what to expect. We had great problems when we first started. We did the show and knowing that it wasn't really a cricket show, but people who took it on in theatres, like the public, didn't quite know what they'd got. And we wanted to impress, as I think we've told you already, that in fact this was a show that was available to everyone and anyone. And you didn't just have to have a knowledge of cricket, or indeed a great interest in cricket.
Funnily enough, it's almost echoed by the reaction when Test Match Special was first switched to Radio 4. Which, in a way, I always felt for a long time before, even when we were on Radio 3 long wave, or medium wave as we were, that probably our natural home of all the networks would have been Radio 4. But what happened was that a network or two had to be given up to the government because of the change in the broadcasting regulations. It was a big thing. And so we were moved on to Radio 4 long wave. And the resistance I met from Radio 4, who were really quite po-faced about having sport on their network. They were really, the lip would curl. When I walked into the Radio 4 offices, they practically made the sign of the cross and hung garlic around their necks. The Antichrist had arrived. And I don't think they allowed themselves actually to listen to it and realise that actually, this programme is so much more than just sport. It's not just a sport. We didn't regard ourselves as just a sports programme. It was John Arlott described it, as folk. And that's really was. And in fact, actually, the previous controller of Radio 3, when it was on his network, described it as an art form.
Stephen Hurst.
He did, yes. And he was a Middle European, an Austrian. He realised that there was value in this thing.
It is this way we go away from the cricket. Brian Johnston always described it as a group of friends come to watch a day's cricket. When the cricket was really exciting, you never left the cricket. Yeah. But when the cricket got rather dull, because a day's cricket is like a symphony concert with the quick bits, the slow bits, the medium bits, but when it gets dull and you get maiden over after maiden over, then the commentator can afford to go over the boundary and look for other things. And it's then, in my view, that the commentator has to remember that he's an entertainer as well just as a purveyor of fact. And I think that's important. And I think, too, we've got to remember here that we're entertaining, and that's what it's all about. If there is cricket or if there is commentary box, that's just the way what we use to entertain with.
He's trying to justify all the pigeons and buses and all that rubbish.
I was going to mention the buses, but I thought I'd better not.
They're awfully good looking, sometimes thoughtful buses.
Well, thought I know, and pigeons.
You two have worked together for a very long time.
Well, yeah, I took over as producer of the programme in 1973. Blowers had made his debut doing One Day Internationals in September or August the year before.
August or September the year before. Yeah.
And then he got his first test match in 74, so it was all about that time, yeah.
So, after 41 years together, does this kind of show where you are very much in each other's pockets permanently for a month strike as being most the wonderful opportunity or the worst thing ever?
Almost literally, because we're sharing a flat.
We're sharing a flat here. I've got my wife with me and back. We've always got on very well indeed. Yeah. We get on, but I don't think we great against each other particularly.
No, we're not at each other's throats.
We're not, absolutely.
Yet.
No, I mean, it's good fun when the show is going well, and I think that's something you've got to remember. If you suddenly have a show that's not going off well, is going off the rails, then everything, then it can become more difficult. But at the moment, we've got a show that seems to work.
Have you ever had a show that's gone off the rails?
No.
They go off the rails. Sometimes you can get sticky audiences in some places. And usually, we know now the signs, don't we? When an audience if they sit spread out, if they're in a big auditorium, and so they've been allowed just to spread out, they don't dare laugh. It's very, it's a very funny thing. I don't know why. They get self-conscious, and so they don't laugh.
There's no belly laughs when you get...
It's terribly difficult. Suddenly, if it's very hard work, if you don't, if you tell a joke and you don't get any reaction at all, and you're hurrying on to the next one...
You use also twice as much material.
Well, there's that too, yeah.
There's an odd theatrical thing that happens sometimes where laughter comes from a certain bits of an auditorium and not at all from other. And I've sort of sat in the front of a theatre and heard everything from way behind me, and in one side it's come from the other.
I don't think I've encountered that quite, but...
What we do after almost every show is say to ourselves, well, that got a good laugh today, much better than it was yesterday.
Absolutely.
Why?
Yeah.
You can't second guess the retail trade, which is really what it amounts to, isn't it?
Absolutely. It is. And does that mean that you are deliberately adapting, so, oh, that one got a good laugh, we'll put that in tomorrow, or that one didn't really go down well, we'll leave it out?
Oh, yeah,
we don't do that. We know that over a period of time they've all got good laughs. And it's just simply a question of how the audience sees it. And if something falls flat today, we certainly don't think of leaving it out tomorrow. And I suppose the person who produces it may tell the story a little bit more carefully. But that's...
We may sometimes discuss why didn't they realise it's usually timing that's done it, that's actually messed it up.
So do you see yourselves, well, very much sitting down, but stand-up comedians?
My daughter described it as our own brand of sit-down comedy.
I don't think it's a we're stand-up comics. And stand-up comics do it, don't they? They don't base it on something that really actually happened. It's all from the imagination, isn't it?
And there's a great variety. With a thousand of them up here, they'll do anything and everything you can imagine.
Things, I suppose
Some of them tell stories that, at least apparently, are what happened to them in the last year. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, some will be somewhere.
It's a funny thing, because we appear in the brochure, of course, in the spoken word section.
Yeah, I had to search for you. I was looking at the theatre, then comedy, and I got
there eventually. Our agent's been very clever. She's got an advertisement for us in the comedy section. So, actually, we're in both, effectively. Which is
a good thing.
Yeah. Because in a way, I would have thought, depends if you know what the show is about, whether you would look in the comedy section or not.
But I think, I think it's nice to be thought of as comedy, isn't it? I mean, I think we are. Yeah. I mean, when you've seen the show.
Yes.
And you know the laughs come fairly thick and fast, don't they?
Yes.
And I mean, there are one or two moments when we talk about, we talk about Arliss at the end, and I talk about the fact that radio paints better pictures than television. Well, that's not a humorous thing. That's just, I think, quite an interesting observation.
Yes,
you know, and one tries to explain briefly why that should be so. Mm. But, I mean, by and large, we're playing for laughs. Yeah, we are. But playing for laughs on the basis of stories that are there, that are action stories of things that happened. Mm. We aren't sort of imagining things. I mean, okay, there may be occasions when we slightly embellish a story, you know, but it's not done much more than that.
What is your favourite story?
Oh dear, I suppose the Queen's Cake is quite a favourite, which is why we finish with it.
I'm not going to get you to retell it on the air because no one will come to the show, so I've certainly no intentions of doing that.
Well, I hope there's a bit more than just the Queen's Cake in the show. But yes.
Have you got a favourite?
I'm just thinking. I always love. I mean, the Brian Johnston one of the Dachshund at Headingley. Am I allowed to tell that one?
No.
No
one will come.
It's giving me the answer. Absolutely
right.
The other thing I wonder is, you've got one story that I think I can reveal a little bit about. This is Brian Johnston and Jonathan Agnew and the famous Lego story you've both used an awful lot over the years, very reasonably.
Yes.
Has that ever just collapsed the show because you can't get people, either yourselves or anyone else, to stop laughing? Because there's a real risk there.
Well, actually, we've only just here started actually playing the giggle in. We had been just telling the story.
Yes.
But we sort of thought, well, we don't play the whole of the clip. Mm. Where he does the right from the moment when Agus says it.
Yes.
But just the laugh, because that is the bit that makes people laugh.
And as you said, it's totally infectious.
Sound of Jonas laughing.
Mm.
It is extraordinary. I mean, it was the most infectious. There was an 81-year-old absolutely howling with laughter.
Yes.
And it was just, it's impossible. I mean, how many times have we heard it over the last 20 years?
And it's still funny.
It still makes us
we
laugh.
Hear yeah. it, we hear it every day here at
yes.
Edinburgh.
Genuinely.
And
you laugh every
time. And we genuinely laugh,
yeah.
yes.
And I love the reaction you get from the audience.
Yes.
You know, just to look at the front row and see them corpsing, it's splendid. Yeah. Actually, there was one woman tonight who was a bit in the... there's a story that isn't in our show, but about Christopher Martin Jenkins doing an after-dinner speech in Yorkshire. And his eye fell on two old blokes who wouldn't laugh at all, wouldn't crack a smile. And eventually when he sat down, he heard one say to the other, "What do you make of Speaker then?" And the other one said, "He's all right, if you like laughing." And this evening, my eye kept falling on a woman who was a bit like that.
Really?
Just over to your right, so you wouldn't have seen
it. I wouldn't have seen it.
Out of your eye line. And I glanced across when the leg over clip was being played, and at last we got a laugh. She cracked a smile. John has done it.
well done him. But I mean, I think steady as she goes, and it's terrific fun, and we're very lucky to be here.
Yes. I'm very careful how I phrase this because there are two people who could both attack me. But the general perception of the Edinburgh Fringe, I think, is probably of students maybe at university who bring a very bad show up and just have lots and lots of fun and sort of appear on stage occasionally
yes.
until 5 or 6 in the morning, etc. When you both made your Edinburgh debuts, you were not so much students as people who probably could get a discount going to a show for another reason.
But I don't think this is this really still... I mean, it used to be applicable.
With 3,000 shows, everything applies.
Yeah, I know, but I mean,
exactly.
there are...
It's an incredible
When you wouldn't think of Paul Merton, for example...
Or Dame Diana Rigg.
They're in the fringe.
Yes.
And so you rather say that as though we're on our own, which
not at all. It was much more to get a feel for your perceptions of Edinburgh. So you're in Edinburgh during the Fringe, during the festival. Is it great fun?
Oh, yes,
terrific, doing a
job? Terrific
well,
fun.
Blurs is more experienced than me.
I've done, yes.
My eyes are completely open last year. I mean, I last came to the festival when I was about 8 and went to see the Tattoo. And I hadn't been since then. I'd sort of been told by my relations Edinburgh is a place to avoid during the Fringe. So I just... The buzz last year was just... Yeah. It just blew me away. It's wonderful. But it is, as you said, it's all things, really. And I certainly didn't have that feeling as a student. I mean, there is a lot of that, obviously, but there are so many thousands of shows. I mean, the thing that really blew me away is how difficult it is to get anyone to know you're here.
Yes.
Just because there are so many things on.
That's absolutely right.
That's really...
Yes, I mean, I think it's... It's an interesting exercise, actually, intellectually for us. We do 2 acts of an hour each normally in our shows, and to do the, get it down to tightly within an hour. I regard this as something that, not frivolous in any way at all. It was fun, but not frivolous fun. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think it is quite an intellectual challenge, actually,
it is,
isn't it?
It is, absolutely. We spent a long time trying to remember what we'd done last year so that we could decide what to do.
And we had a day where we were down in our agent's family house in Sussex where we had about 50 or 60 people and we did 2 hour-long shows in a day just as a sort of run-through of what we were going to do here. So I mean, we worked quite hard at it. And I think therefore, the analogy, I mean, the thing... being a student thing. I don't think so. I think we take it as a very serious theatre operation.
I'm sure so do the students who, after all, they're hoping they're going to launch a comedy career, most of them, or a music career.
Well, I'm sure, and think of a great many haven't they? Yeah.
But it's...
I mean, it's the Edinburgh Festival must have spawned an awful lot.
Oh, incredible.
Well, it is largely a place for trying out stuff, and I suppose in a way we are not doing we're not trying out stuff, we're doing the reverse.
We're going to be next year, so we're doing a different show next year. And yes, which we thought about already. And it won't be, you won't hear, you might hear one story from this, but it's going to be a different dialogue.
This is the place where we'll try and...
We shall launch it, actually, here.
Excellent.
So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that one goes.
Do you have a title for it yet, or...
No, we haven't.
Cheers.
we are agents playing around with titles, you know. We're not sort of we haven't got a title is actually the answer to that. But she's got, I can't even remember what she is suggesting, but
We were at the stage where we have bandied around a few things, but nothing has been and certainly not been decided.
Have you been watching anything yet this year?
No, we're in the process of drawing up. There seems to be something every day that we're asked to do, so we haven't really been able to get to something. But I think we are getting to the stage where we're forging a list of the things we want to see.
Yeah, the first week, you know, there's so much you've got to get established, and there are lots of Nicholas Parsons shows and things like that that we've been doing, and which is the most important thing to get ourselves established here. And then,
so that's your equivalent to handing out flyers on the Royal Mile, is it?
Well, yeah.
We've been doing that. We're not on the Royal Mile, but we have been.
We do that. We do flyers every day for an hour and a half, from about 2 o'clock to 3:30, and we're outside. We're in here. I suppose we got rid of something like 200 flyers between this today. So we get our hands dirty in that way.
People say to me, "Which one are you?" And they look at the picture, and I have to sue them.
So, what one of you tell the audience exactly the name of your show? It's on at 4:20 in.
It's Blofeld and Baxter, Memories of Test Match Special, and it's on 4:20 every afternoon in the Pleasance Dome, the Queen Dome, which is venue number 23. Sorry, the courtyard's 33.
There are people with a cricketing knowledge of numbers.
Yeah, I don't think anyone does it by numbers, do they? It's the Pleasance Dome.
It's the Pleasance Dome, but it is actually the Queen number Dome. 23.
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed. That was fascinating, and good luck for the rest of your stay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think it's very kind.